The Washington Post was recently sold to internet billionaire Jeff Bezos, and the New York Times is now substantially owned by the richest man in Mexico, Carlos Slim. Are news organizations all to become ornaments of the rich, or can they instead remain profitable entities? Today, one journalist who is betting his career on the latter, the chief executive officer of News Corp, Robert Thompson. From the offices of the Wall Street Journal in Washington, D.C., Uncommon Knowledge now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. With us today, Robert Thompson, Chief Executive Officer of News Corp. News Corp's properties include well over 100 newspapers, including the Wall Street Journal, the Australian, and the Times of London, and one of the half dozen biggest book publishers in the United States, HarperCollins, and the biggest real estate listing agency in Australia, REA. Born and raised in Australia, Robert Thompson has been in the news business since joining the Melbourne Herald as a copy boy at the age of 18. Robert Thompson, welcome.
Thank you, Peter.
The new news. Beginning with a part ownership of a newspaper in Adelaide, some 6 decades ago, your fellow Australian, Rupert Murdoch, began building what became known as the News Corporation, an enterprise that at its height represented one of the biggest media companies in the world. Then Rupert Murdoch decided to split the company in two. How come?
Solomonic. It was Solomonic. But unlike King Solomon, he actually did it.
He actually did do it.
But your question, ornamental or fundamental, certainly I'm not good looking enough to be ornamental, but I hope it's fundamental. But the issue of the split was of itself fundamental because we needed to focus on the elements of the company that would become the new news, because with that focus comes, and it's a terrible word to use, but people know what I'm talking about, synergy.
Right.
That comes out of that focus, and we're seeing that on both the Fox side, 21st Century Fox, and at the new news. And at a time, clearly, the word transition doesn't capture the degree of upheaval. At a time of enormous transition in media, what we half-jokingly referred to as the transition from Gutenberg to Zuckerberg, you do need focus, because if you don't, you'll get distracted. And as we've seen with media companies that have been distracted, distraction precedes death.
All right. As I read the situation and read what other people say about the situation, it's possible to put it even more dramatically than that.
Is it more dramatically than death?
As follows.
The afterlife.
So in the new 21st Century Fox went the broadcasting and electronic properties, the Fox Studios, Fox News, and so forth, off in that direction. And in the company of which you are CEO, newspapers, book publishing, and
coupons, which are in newspapers.
But fundamentally, what analysts, certainly in my world out in Northern California, would view as old-fashioned businesses, the business model for which classified ads, a certain kind of advertising, a certain kind of subscription. Newspapers used to be monopoly properties, in this country at least. They used to be monopoly or semi-monopoly properties in their communities. Now they're competing with everything online. And so this was a division between companies that have a clear profitability and future and companies over which hangs an enormous question mark. And you are tasked with reinventing a business model for journalism.
Well, I prefer an exclamation mark to a question mark.
All right.
Or some other
form
of
punctuation.
But
you take the larger point.
I take the larger point, and it's a very fair point. And to see the demise of great papers, to know that virtually every paper and magazine from Boston to LA is basically on the market at the moment tells you how dramatic the situation in which we find. It is an editorially existential moment. And I think you're right in, who are the competitors? Because for 10 or 15 years as an editor, you get the question, who is your competitor? And it's an aggregation of aggregators is really what the competitor set is. Because the traditional, is it the Wall Street Journal versus the New York Times, doesn't for a moment capture the complexity of content competition in the contemporary age. And that's what's made the response so difficult for so many papers. And The response will differ according to where the paper finds itself on the spectrum. Mm-hmm. So for specialist papers, it's a little easier, whether it's the Wall Street Journal or, say, the Times of London or the Australian.
Why would you say the Times of London is a specialist paper?
Because it's almost a virtuous vertical. I mean, it is what you might call a hierarchical segment, which is somewhat specialist in its orientation, and it's a little easier for that kind of paper to create a community, and out of community affinity both in readership and advertising. It's a little more difficult for mid-market papers where the aggregation of aggregators and the competition generated by that aggregation is ever more intense.
So when I actually did do this the other morning, when I went out to pick up the newspapers, I looked around to see what my neighbors are getting. This is Palo Alto, California. The newspapers I have delivered, slapped onto my driveway each morning, are the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times. And I looked around, and that was pretty much what others were getting as well. The point being, no longer the San Jose Mercury News, no longer the San Francisco Chronicle. And you're not surprised by that. The mid-market paper, like the San Jose Mercury News, which for a time, as tech was taking off in the early 90s, was a big-time newspaper, is now a small newspaper. And the Wall Street Journal, I suppose this is something, News Corp has owned the journal for 5 years now?
7 years.
7 years, and you've made it a national paper. That's a huge success story, is that right?
Well, it is. I mean, a great many people contributed, and frankly, under Rupert's leadership, and it has been a success. We've managed to broaden the paper without diminishing its influence, in fact, expanding its influence. And the part of it, because when you think about what is the functional relationship you have with a specialist paper like the Wall Street Journal, for the very high-end financial reader, what is the best way of getting financial news? Sometimes, frankly, it's by mobile rather than by a website or by print. So you want to have a combination of both the functional and the emotional. And that building out the character of the journal has strengthened the emotional tie both with core readers and families. And so the creation of the contemporary weekend edition, the Friday edition, the mansion section, just in New York, the greater New York, the personal journal and the renaissance there under a very clever team of editors and reporters. That has all added to the emotional component, which gives a stickiness to the, to be very technical about it, to the product that it didn't have in the past. And also on the web, obviously, gives you, on the free side of the pay barrier, gives you much greater audience traction. When we started to recast the journal, of course, making the functional side ever better and serving that very discerning audience who knows what they need to read on a need-to-know basis. You can never fool a specialist financial reader. But yes, serving that audience, but just broadening it out in a way that didn't seem a betrayal of the journal's traditions.
Okay, Robert Thompson, this is from an interview you gave a few years ago. Readers are digitally non-denominational, and they have never had more choice than they have now. Whether readers will pay for digital content is now the question. Mm. Is an answer to the question in? Is that still an open? I mean, in some way, you're staking your career on the answer to that, right?
Well, the answer is yes, but it's different for different media properties. But at the heart of a lot of it is what you might call winnowing and windowing. In the sense that you have to customize content in a way that makes sense to a paying subscriber and think more in terms of membership than subscription. And you're seeing that in particular at the Times of London now, mm-hmm. where you have year-on-year good sales figures. You have where people attend a function that's hosted by the Times. The renewal rate is extraordinarily high because they feel an affinity. And understanding the value, the imperative of affinity is something that newspapers have been very, very slack about. Because when you think of, in an age of constant interaction, not infantilism, but instantilism, where people expect immediate gratification, unless you're very conscious of the texture of the relationship and the amount of interaction you have with readers, then you'll lose them. And so creating these affinity sets has been at the heart of the Times success and is a model that we're replicating elsewhere in the company.
So you're no longer publishing newspapers, you're creating communities. Is that a fair way of putting it?
Yeah, well, newspapers have always created communities, but when you think, was there much interaction really between a newspaper and its community? And not as much as the newspapers thought. And in part it was, what was your dialogue? What was your conversation with the community? Well, it was a letter to the editor, right. It was a complaint about a paper not being delivered. What we've discovered is that it wasn't as textured a relationship as it should have been. And in part, that's the fault of the journalistic priesthood, where they were separate from the needs of readers, mm-hmm. where journalism is meant to be providing a narrative about the evolution of society, hopefully with the objective of being objective. But instead, I think there's been a self-indulgent institutional narrative where the priority, almost a prerogative for some journalists, has been the prize. And by
the Pulitzer Prize or the good opinion of their fellow journalists.
Yeah, and so what essentially is an elite has focused on an elite and has lost the audience.
Once again, let me quote you. A young person today has been socialized visually in a totally different manner to the way we've been socialized. Explain that.
Well, when you think, I don't know how old you are, Peter. 32,
older than
33.
You. Oh, thank you, Robert.
But when you
these
think,
questions are much too hard for a lovely man like you.
When you look at what we watched, you know, what we imbibed visually as kids, you know, during the
oh, it's all very crude stuff.
Yeah,
the Flintstones.
Crude visually, I'm sure,
right,
not in substance. And you compare that to the range of imagery, you know, some of it's disturbing, but a lot of it creative, that anyone between the age of 12 and 18 is now consuming. And that must raise the level of visual acuity to a point where if you have a conventional, traditional newspaper approach to visuals, you've lost that audience as well. You're not talking to that audience in a visual language that it understands. And that's through for everything from the emoticon to the rise of video. And you think of a video now and the debates we're having about the role of it. And I think at the moment, you know, about five, 6 years ago, I think it was about 5 hours of video was uploaded every minute. It's now 100 hours of video.
Okay, so let me give you, if we address this generational question, two models, and you tell me where newspapers fall. Model number one would be cosmetics companies. I probably shouldn't mention the name here, but I was talking with an executive and I said, why did you bring out, the name of the company is such and such, but they also have this line and that line, and you can find the same products in each line as a face cleanser and a cream and this and that. And the answer was, nobody wants to use her mother's cosmetics.
Mm.
You want to be different from your parents. Take the other extreme, which is political identification. Every political scientist tells us that the overwhelmingly strongest predictor of whether this child will become a Republican or a Democrat is whether he or she was raised in a Democratic or a Republican family. It's just automatic in a very large number of cases. Where do newspapers fall?
Mm. Well, first of all, full confession on the question of cosmetics. Both Peter and I are wearing makeup for the cameras. That's full disclosure. I can understand. That's sort of true, but I don't think it's partly reaction, rejection. But it's also evolution of taste among young people, and that whether it's political taste or media taste. And to be honest, the word newspaper doesn't quite capture the sense of a newspaper as a platform. You know, and the platform permutations of media now. Again, it's not something I think traditional newspapers and other companies truly understood the power of those platform permutations and how you can touch people of different ages in different ways, because you're able to segment content and create virtuous verticals that are valuable to different audiences at different stages, but both in the way you deliver the content, in the content you deliver, and the presentation of the content, i.e. the visuals around it, the nature of the scripting, It has to be relevant, because if you're not having a conversation, it's a soliloquy.
Right, right. Let's go through a few of the things you've done as CEO, or just before the company began its own its independent existence. And let's go through a couple of specifics. Tell us what you were thinking and what they've accomplished for the company. The purchase of Storyful, which is a Dublin-based.
It's a little room in a very increasingly trendy area of Dublin. And it's a wonderful confluence of technologists and journalists. And they're using traditional journalistic skills to verify and authenticate video. Because there's a lot of video out there of dubious provenance. And if it's of dubious provenance, it's of dubious value. And so the team there, under Mark Little, an ex-journalist himself, still is in really most respects, is using the sort of skills that any journalist would use to check on the sourcing, check on the timing, and doing everything they can to then create a stream of the verifiable video that's of value to the world's leading news organizations.
So if there's a tsunami somewhere in the world, people will be uploading their iPhone videos of this, and Storyful will be able to verify that a certain video is genuinely the tsunami, and sort of certify it and be able to make it available to news organizations, and all of this happens fast.
Exactly. It's a combination of very, very clever algorithms and human judgment about, you know, where was this uploaded? Was it in the region of the tragedy? What time was it uploaded? Who uploaded it? And being able to match that person against a spectrum of individuals who have a track record in frankly being honourable, then reaching out to that person if you can, and if it's a very troubled region, obviously that's difficult. But both the skill set they have and the software they've created are quite unique, and which is why most major news organisations are now using them.
And by the way, we speak a couple of days after Facebook paid $19 billion for WhatsApp. And you picked up Storyful for $25 million, as I recall.
Yeah, well, it's different, but
it is. But those Dubliners may ask for a Christmas bonus from you, right? WSJ.D.
Yeah,
another innovation. This went active, as I recall, went live on January 1st.
Correct.
What is it, and what does it attempt to do for you?
We had a property called All Things Digital, which Walt Mossberg and Kara Swisher created and did, frankly, a wonderful job in building up a new platform. We wanted really to bring it back more to the Wall Street Journal and put pressure on the journalists to break more stories, because the journal should have the best contacts, it should have the best stories. Do it in a way that's, one, contemporary, but two, creative in the right sense of the word, in that they're looking for new ways of reporting stories. They're more global in the way, because digital is not Palo Alto as important as Palo Alto is in the world. And
it pains me to admit it, but I have to grant the point.
Because you can't really understand digital unless you understand what LG and Samsung and Xiaomi in China and Lenovo and the literally thousands of Chinese software companies that have aspirations far beyond the boundaries of Beijing and India and so on. And that's what the journal can do in a way that really no one else can. And so we wanted to channel that great editorial expertise into D.
All right. DJX, this was an effort to combine a number of Dow Jones products. Dow Jones is the owner of the Wall Street Journal, but also has a number of other properties. And as best I can tell, it's not me, you've been quoted in the press as saying it didn't quite work, or it hasn't quite worked so far. So you're going to be making some changes. What was it? What do you intend to do with it?
Well, Dow Jones has great properties, and the idea behind DJX...
You better name a couple of them. Barron's?
So Barron's, Factiva, Dow Jones Newswire, Risk and Compliance, Capital Markets, generally various products in that realm. And there wasn't a coherence to the content, and that these products weren't talking to each other. So the core idea is to bring together the content so that if you're a Factiva customer, that you also have access to immediate updates from the Newswires. And if you're a Newswires customer, you have access to the to the wonderful trove of content that is Factiva. And to be very honest, we have to refine the product, the pitch and the pricing. We're a little too rigid and we've listened to the customers and we are going to be more flexible. And we're out there, as we speak, talking to our clients and helping ourselves understand what sort of information they need to help their business. Because in the end, businesses know what's of value to them and they can put a price on it. We don't want a plethora of prices.
So you actually have your sales force or executive, somebody in your organization is actually making phone calls and getting on subways to go downtown and talk. You are actually talking one by one by one to customers.
Exactly. And so we got feedback and to be honest, we're responding to that feedback. And you'll see over coming months, how we can make Factiva even more compelling than it's traditionally been. Because Factiva is a remarkable resource, but it's only as useful as the information that we can surface for you. And so refining search, and making it's a much more professional content set than, say, a Google search, where all sorts of things are thrown up that may or may not be.
By the way, Robert, you are also, this is one of the famous Robert Thompson quotations, quote, "Google devalues everything it touches." That dates from 5 years ago. Would you like to recant? Or
decant.
Or up the ante on
no,
that one.
Well, I think it's true because it devalues content. I mean, increases value for Google. So it's not a criticism of their strategy from a Google perspective, but it is a criticism from the perspective of one who has been aggregated. And if it sounds painful, it is to be aggregated. The aggravation of aggregation. And the truth is that Google News looks like a front page, but Google doesn't really have any journalists.
They're not paying those.
Journalists
are expensive.
It's the repurposing. And the more fundamental way of looking at it is that there's been a shift in value across the content set. So that the creators of content have lost value and the distributors of content have gained in value. Whether you think of Yahoo, Google, Facebook Newsstream, which is the turnaround product for Facebook on mobile. Facebook doesn't have journalists, but it has news. And so it's distributors are doing very, very well, and the creators are doing less well. And so one of the questions for creators is, how do you find other distribution platforms that are much more in line with our interests and are not inimical institutionally to our interests? And that's one of the things
So the Rubicon project, explain that.
Well, Rubicon is a company that we have a stake in, and it helps us. We've created an internal advertising network.
Basically. So this is one of these synergies. You used the dread word early on.
Yeah.
That you own so many properties, you may as well be your own sales.
Contemporary advertisements are two things. One, they're advertisements, and two, they're sources of data about who's visiting your website and who may or may not be clicking on the ad. And I think we've priced them as ads without understanding the value of the data collection.
I see.
And part of what we're doing with the advertising network is ensuring that we keep the data, but also stopping that what seemed to be an inevitable trend downwards in CPMs, the price that you can charge for an advertisement. Because if you allow third parties to sell, they'll stack them high and sell them cheap, which is not what you want for the world's most prestigious influential news properties, which is what we have.
By the way, can I also ask, broadly speaking, is it working? The Times of London, you're charging online for the Times of London.
Well, is it work? Look, it's so early in the strategy. The Times of London is doing a very good job. The Sun, we now have just over 100,000 paying subscribers.
Paying subscribers online for the Sun.
Online for the Sun.
As against the 3 million newsstand sale?
No, it's more like over 2 million.
All right.
And weekday. And it's just so early in that cycle for The Sun that I can't tell you now what the churn rate will be. I can't tell you, therefore I can't tell you what the retention rate will be. I can't tell you what the elasticity is in that audience. But what you can see is that the idea of an affinity is working. So it's not just content, it's special offers that The Sun will give readers. It's in Britain football, which is really important. So exclusive access to the highlights of a soccer game. And you don't need many highlights because they don't score many goals in soccer. But the only place you can see those goals
is the Sun.
Is the Sun or the Times.
So we bought the Sun or the Times, I see.
We bought them through the parent. And so there's a value to it. People can see the value in that video, and they associate that value with the Sun. And so over the longer term, I think we're confident that that's the right strategy. And in the short term, the returns have been positive.
One more step that you took. This is actually before you became CEO, because it's before the company began trading as a company in its own right. But early last year, you closed The Daily, which was a publication that the old News Corporation had launched to be native to mobile devices. The Daily, according to what I was able to find using that dread instrument group, Google, was losing about 10 to 20 million a year. But, and this is what's so striking, you praised it even as you shut it down. This is quoting you, this is from Forbes, it's you. Quote, The Daily was actually a great success in most respects, revenue aside. Now, there we have an arresting formulation by a soon-to-be CEO. Revenue aside, comma. The losses were irrelevant to the ongoing, enduring contribution The Daily has made to News Corporation and to me as an executive, Thompson said, adding that the company ought to be engaging in more such experiments. So you really want your entire organization to understand that this company has to be experimental, that you're willing to spend money trying things out.
Exactly. Well, Rupert said when we had the spin that he wanted a startup sensibility. And a startup sensibility is to try something, to do everything you can to make it work. If after a period of striving, it's clear that it's not going to work, you then have to have the courage to say, you know what, this is not work. We've learned a lot, and everything I said remains very true. We've learned so much from that daily experience about tablets, about digital migration, and the patterns of readership that come with digital migration. And if we hadn't done the daily, we wouldn't be in the position that we are now with our tablet properties around the world. But there will be things that we should try, and some of those things won't work. But particularly in this era, if you're not experimenting within reason, and it can't always be revenue aside, but within reason, and if you're learning from the things that don't work, because if something doesn't work, you have learned something about your dialogue with audiences. You know, what is it about that didn't quite work? As long as you're open to that, and as long as you have a culture where people are not pilloried for trying new things, then you will find after a period that you have a group of individuals who are highly motivated, they're not beaten down, they've learnt a lot from their experiences, and they'll be in a far better position than employees at other companies to take advantage of the opportunities. Because we talk about the challenges, but
I know you have
many opportunities.
You're an experienced journalist, and we're sitting in Washington, not Palo Alto, and you've already said tech is not centered, Palo Alto is not the center of the world, but you sound like a 25-year-old startup executive.
I wish I looked like a 25-year-old startup executive.
All right.
I wish I was paid like a 25-year-old startup executive.
Saving journalism, two quotations from Robert Thompson. Quotation one, there is clearly a social role for good journalism. That's one. Here's the second one. There's a great tendency for journalists to be high and mighty. Mm. They've existed in a kind of splendid isolation. They've been self-referential and self-reverential. Mm. Close quote. What is the social role for journalism, and why do journalists tend to be high and mighty?
Well, I think they imbibe of ego a little too much. I think again, it's true that there is a sense of sacredness, and it's what you might, in part, it's Robert Redford's fault for having portrayed Bob Woodward. I mean, those of us who met Bob Woodward know that, you know. Robert Redford and Bob Woodward don't look the same, and in fact, they don't talk the same. But it sort of perpetuated something of a myth about journalism, a romantic myth. And then you have what you might call EBS, which is Erin Brockovich syndrome, where journalists are chasing injustice, and of course, injustice should be pursued. But in a way that's often, I hate to say, as much about the journalist as it is about the injustice. And that is an injustice to journalism.
So how do you square that one, Robert? Because you really truly believe, you really do believe when it comes down to it, that journalism is in some way almost sacred. It is fundamental to the life of a healthy democracy. You really believe that?
Well, the social role of journalism is sacred.
But you want your journalists to behave like...
The journalists should be feisty. You know, they shouldn't be, you know, we joke, they shouldn't be either lapdogs with laptops, or they shouldn't imagine that they're set apart from society in a way that they have an immensely privileged role. You have to critique yourself as much as you critique society. And I think journalism, not all journalists by any means, I mean, there are great journalists who are blessed with humility, but there are journalists who are so self-regarding, I think they've lost their bearings. Mm.
Do you think that was the self-regard, the self-referential and self-reverential, was a function of the old days when certain newspapers were essentially local monopolies and the money was easy?
Well, partly that, but it's a national syndrome in many respects. But it has left exposed the irrelevance of journalism at a time when media has evolved exponentially. You know, the tide has gone out.
Right.
And what we have...
There's Bob Woodward sitting on the beach.
Yeah, we have a lot of unemployed journalists with high opinions of themselves.
Right. Back to Storyful. It used to be the case that professional journalists and reporters and editors gathered or uncovered the news, investigative journalism uncovering the news, and the masthead of the newspaper gave the news the authority and credibility. So if you saw it in the Wall Street Journal, it was true. Now, Storyful has replaced reporters with crowdsourcing, and to some extent it's replaced editors with algorithms. And so it's scanning Twitter and YouTube. And then the verification comes from crowdsourcing, not a masthead. So I put it to you, you who have made your life as a journalist, do we need journalism anymore?
Well, actually, Storyful still relies on journalistic judgment.
Good. Correct me. I'm very relieved
so it's
to hear
not,
this.
It's
Tell
not,
me, the, reassure me that there's a human element that remains in.
Oh, very, very much so. And that's what makes it unique, the blending of the two. Because technology is powerful, but judgment is essential.
It's still irreplaceable?
It's essential. Because, you know, when does crowdsourcing become mass hysteria? You know, it's important that you're able to divine and... You know, the human is divine in the divining of, you know, do I trust this person? And these are instincts. These are powerful, important journalistic instincts that are an essential ingredient of what Storyful does.
Mm, okay. I can't tell you how reassured I am to hear that. Robert Thompson, CEO, the founder of your company, Rupert Murdoch, has a certain political outlook, as do the editorial pages of some of your newspapers. And his career has displayed a certain affection for the tabloid. Here is a columnist in The Guardian on you, Robert Thompson. Quote, he's quiet, almost introverted, thin and thoughtful. He takes time, sometimes a lot of time, to make up his mind. He's no right winger to the irascible manner born, which means, frankly, that he's an unlikely choice to superintend rumbustious tabloids and News Corp. What has The Guardian got wrong?
Well, it was in The Guardian for a start, so...
you speak of your ancestral enemy.
Well, I'm thin, somewhat thin. That bit is accurate. I wear thin ties, my fashion sense. They may have captured that. But the myths around the company, as you know, are myths. So there's more caricature than character. And this is a very diverse company. You look across the range of things that in both the Fox Group and at News. And so the way that people jump to these conclusions about personality types and political orientation tells you more about preconception than it does about reality.
You were a foreign correspondent for the Financial Times. If I'm recalling this correctly, Robert, correct me, it was 5 years in Japan and 4 years in
About
China,
that, yeah.
roughly.
A little less than 4 years.
All right. And then you were the editor of the Financial Times here in Washington. You were the American editor. Is that...
No, that's incorrect. So I was, after Japan, I became the foreign news editor of the Financial Times in London.
Right.
And then the editor of the Weekend Financial Times in London, and then came here. To New York.
To New York.
Establish the Financial Times in the U.S.
And under your editorship as the editor in New York, the American readership tripled. Okay. That is a description of a newspaper man's career. Mm-hmm. You are now an executive, as we have just spent some 20 minutes displaying. You are talking about algorithms and CPMs and all the new digital world. You also just completed, it was a couple of weeks ago, I called it up, your second earnings call. You're having to talk to analysts about this or that aspect that will affect the financial results of the company over the coming quarter, the last quarter. How do you like being a CEO? It's different,
isn't
it?
It's great. And of this company, with you know the diversity that we've been discussing, it's just such an eclectic experience. And each day, you are discovering new things that have both a commercial purpose and a social relevance. I mean, that's the heart of News Corporation.
So you're in Clover.
Oh, I am in Clover. Yeah, well particularly in Dublin. But the distinction between the two, I suppose I've spent most of my life as a business journalist critiquing companies.
I see.
And having critiqued them, I now have the responsibility of overseeing one. And hopefully I've learned from the mistakes and also the successes of other companies. And I have around me a great group of people. And the executives, Brian Murray at HarperCollins, you know, Mike Darcy in the UK. We have a team that
these are impressive people.
These are very able individuals, and I'm learning a lot from them as I'm theoretically overseeing them.
Last couple of questions, Robert, because you do have a company to run. A few weeks ago, as I mentioned, you announced your quarterly earnings. Here's the headline from Bloomberg Businessweek: "Quote: News Corp shares jump after earnings beat analysts' estimates." Congratulations. But here's a couple of sentences in. Digital real estate services were the fastest growing major division. Book publishing revenue increased. News publishing revenue, which still accounts for more than 70% of the company's total sales, declined. Mm-hmm. Close quote. So what's the plan here? You've got this real estate company in Australia. Is News going to remain a news organization?
News at the heart of news, but if real estate traditionally classifieds are in newspapers, and there's a very close relationship between REA and our Australian newspapers. So these are not eccentric investments by any means, and there's a complementarity in the character of what they do. We are in the midst of transition. It's going to take a certain amount of time before papers that were papers truly become platforms. And that evolution will be different for different papers in different cities. And I think that's one of the lessons, that there's no rigid template for the successful transition of a newspaper. It depends on what type of newspaper, it depends where in the spectrum, it depends what else is happening in that particular society, whether it be Perth in Western Australia or London, England. And to be conscious of the competitor set, but also conscious that the technological developments are creating opportunities. And that's, we see it as threat, and obviously there's an element of threat there if you make the wrong decisions. But it is much more opportunity than threat, because the potential to touch more people, the potential for audience expectation to change around, for example, payment. Should I pay for content? And if I pay for content, what type of content will that be? Those things are continuing to evolve. And we freeze a frame of that evolution now. And what we're seeing is a very incomplete picture. So it is...
You just touched on a point that hadn't occurred to me, frankly, but I'm going to ask it now anyway. And that's what the business schools call span of control. Mm-hmm. I think, for example, of Ford Motor Company as a great big complicated company. But I don't know how many models Ford produces, but maybe 8 cars mm-hmm. across a couple of dozen different factories. That's actually quite a finite set. You just said that it's going to be different newspaper by newspaper by newspaper. And this company owns dozens and dozens of newspapers, let alone the book publishing, let alone the real estate. How do you, as CEO, How do you assert a span of control over all that?
That's where you need great people who are talking to each other, whether it's Mike in London talking to Julie in Sydney. But you look at how other elements of e-society are changing. You know, wearables. We were at CES, and you know, people were wearing clunky things, and I always think, you know, fashion before comfort, style before substance. These seem to be neither stylish nor substantial. You know, the jawbone fashion, you know that we're in an early stage of... Because at the moment, people...
Big ugly objects that aren't actually all that useful
well,
yet.
Well, sort of a mini monument to a lack of self-discipline. That's what a jawbone is. You know that senses make sense. You know, there are going to be, we're going to use senses both for health reasons and personal reasons. You know, but you know they're going to be far more subtle than they are now. But it's, you know, that's exciting to watch. And I think we have to bring the same sort of excitement that we see at CES to the world of content.
Last question. Robert Thompson, again, this is an interview you gave a few years ago. Quote, dead trees are definitely not dead. There's an absolute intensity in the relationship between a reader and a newspaper. Given the web surfing, ad skipping, channel changing consciousness that's out there, the idea of spending 30 minutes with a medium with which the only multitasking you're doing is drinking a cup of coffee as you read your morning newspaper still makes newspapers unique. You have two young kids. When they're your age, will they be reading newspapers?
Well, I have a 14-year-old who is. I mean, he starts at the sports pages, but that's fine. And a 12-year-old.
A newspaper. He's not reading it online?
He reads online, but he also picks up a newspaper. Now, whether my household is representative of the world.
Unlikely, but still, we'll take them.
It may not be a fair comparison. But there is an intensity to the newspaper relationship. Oh, there just is. And you know when you're reading a newspaper that the peripheral distractions are indeed peripheral and you're not being distracted because you're focused. And we are all newspaper owners have to be more articulate, more convincing about what is a real relationship. That very intense relationship between a reader of a newspaper and that content. Because there is digital distraction. It's different. And we go back to intensity, and intensity is part of affinity. And the affinity that people have with papers is something that they're passionate about. And when you talk to people about it, and it's not just old people, it is young people. And one of the things we noticed when we created the Wall Street Journal app, and we were talking to Steve Jobs, actually, about how it should look, and I think there were some people in Apple who wanted it to be a scroll down rather than a scroll across experience. We argued with them backwards and forwards, and in the end, we reached agreement because we wanted it to replicate a newspaper experience. And what we've discovered is that some young people who started with the Wall Street Journal iPad app have progressed to newspapers because it's a progression from an app experience, which is newspaper-like, to the newspaper. So there's a familiarity in that experience, which you would never have thought would be the case.
Robert Thompson, Chief Executive Officer of News Corp, thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
For the Hoover Institution and the Wall Street Journal, I'm Peter Robinson.